The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. Welcome to the BS Report, a Friday heading into Memorial Day weekend. If you missed yesterday's BS Report, we did a little two-parter. Bill Barnwell, NFL over-unders. Joe House talked a little NBA playoffs. But hey, let's keep going. Celtics, Sixers, Game 7, Saturday night. The voice of the Celtics on the radio. WEI? Is it WEI, right?
I just show up and do the games, Bill. I just call the games, and wherever people enjoy them, on whatever radio station, whatever internet site, whatever satellite radio, whatever means of transportation that our call reaches them, the ship's at sea, I'm there. Yes,
well, his name is Sean Grandy. And actually, you know, for anyone who has Sirius, there's a channel called ESPN Extra, which is the channel right after ESPN Radio, and they've been broadcasting every NBA playoff game, and they usually grab the home team's announcers for the feed. And I've heard more than a few minutes of Sean and Cedric Maxwell this year, so it's been nice, a little connection back home.
It's been fun. You're in the car a little too much, is my sense of things.
Well, I'm driving back. If I'm going back from the office at like 5 o'clock and the game's already started. You know, it's funny, though. I was listening to the Indiana-Miami game last night, and they had the Indiana announcers. So, some of these announcers get pretty funny. Like, they get pretty provincial. You guys seem to have avoided that for the most part. But do you see yourself getting to a stage 20 years from now where you're just using we and you're yelling at every call? That could be fun.
I hope not, but that's a gimmick that seems to be pretty popular. So, you know, you have to go with the times. Maybe it's a matter of survival at some point. You have to start going to that, you know, because that's what gets all your, you know, that's what gets the highlights played. People find that amusing. But as you know, as, you know, better than anybody, I am following a legend in Boston, one of the great announcing names of all time, Johnny Most, and that was his entire gimmick every night. So try to go in a different direction. And we have Tommy Heinsohn. And Twitter there's nothing cooler in this day and age than looking during the game. You're online and you're working and you're doing your game and you're calling your game and you're Twittering and you're Facebooking and you're doing all the things you have to do, and you look down and you see that Tommy Heinsohn is a trending topic. That means something really cool has just happened.
That means a tirade has just happened.
Exactly.
Game 7 coming up. The Celtics are, I think, limping to the finish line would be an understatement. It's just like the hits just keep coming. Now, Avery Bradley, who was the youngest and healthiest Celtic as recently as 5 weeks ago, is probably wiped out for the rest of these playoffs. And, you know, I think all Celtics fans and probably the Sixers fans too are in this mode now of no matter who wins this game 7, then you got LeBron and Wade waiting for you. Both of those guys are 100% healthy. And, I don't know. I feel like they can win game 7, but I also don't really want to get my butt kicked in the next round. What's the mood like in Boston right now?
You just summed up exactly what the mood is. And that's the EKG of the playoffs. And that it really changes a week ago after game 3 in both of those series. Every column online, everything was about the Celtics and the Celtics going to the finals, and the Celtics and the Spurs and Tim Duncan and Kevin Garnett, because everything, you know, you have those off days in between games and people have to take the temperature of what's going on and just assume that's what's going to happen. But obviously reality is settling in. When we talked, it may have been the last time we did this, it was the day after Miami had beaten the Celtics, and you realize that night, as difficult as it was for Celtic fans, that you had two Boston starters basically in traction on the sidelines and Miami healthy and galloping to the finish line. And it's starting to feel exactly that way again. And the reason for Boston is because if the Avery Bradley thing plays out this way, and there is some, I don't want to say mystery about it, but there is that one little Willis Reed element that still exists that he could play, where he's getting the different pressure from different people that he should play or he shouldn't play, or he can or it's going to be worse or it's not if he does play. All that still exists. So there's still that potential drama at this stage of Avery Bradley playing. But the Celtics have a puncher's chance against Miami because, and this is an amazing statement from 4 months ago, but they have a chance to beat Miami because of Avery Bradley and the defense he plays against Dwayne Wade.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I don't think the country fully understands like what he was bringing to the table and how big of a void that he's left since his shoulder started popping out, and especially in this series, you know, they really needed his defense against the Philly guards, and he gave him cheap points. They'd get 4 to 5 baskets a game off fast breaks or like his little backdoor cuts, things like that. That, you know, you watch the Celtics, it's a chore for them to score. You know, it's jump shots, and even when Rondo has a fast break, there's really nobody going with him.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest reason why, you know, you could argue this game 7 could end up being like a 71-70 type of final. I just think it's going to be really tough for either team to get anything.
Well, of course it will. And Doug Collins has done a great job of trying, in game 6 especially. I thought Doug Collins had a phenomenal series. It's really enjoyable to watch coaches in the playoffs because it's such a different animal, coaching game to game and making the adjustments and watching the chess match. But obviously, you know, what do you do against Rondo? You just completely clog everything up that he likes to do, and you put the burden on the Celtics to make shots. And if they can't make shots, they're done. If they can't get stops, they can't get the easy baskets that they desperately need. And defensively, the Celtics have played pretty much all year, especially in the second half of that championship level. But as you said, a chore offensively, it's laborious if Rondo cannot do what he wants to do. And it is, you're squeezing out every point. And against, you know, these two series Philadelphia has played against the three best defensive teams in the league this year were Philadelphia, Chicago, and Boston. And we often joke and debate this, whether the series against Chicago 3 years ago was the greatest playoff series ever. And here it is 3 years later, we've got an identical situation going to a Game 7 Saturday night in Boston, and this series has been pretty much bizarro Boston-Chicago from the eye test, trying to sit through it.
Yeah, I don't think anybody will be bouncing their grandkids on their lap telling them about this series. It's been
remember the time LaVoy Allen pick and pop and made that 14-footer?
Yeah, I mean, LaVoy Allen might be one of the heroes of this series because I think he's one of the only people shooting over 45%. I mean, he had a couple 6-for-6 games. Do you buy anything with the extra day rest here with some of the old guys? Because it does seem like that's helped us in the past.
Well, it played out, certainly, against, you know, in the last series. It played out a little bit against Atlanta, you know, in that fourth game. It played out when the Celtics came back. They've had the two easiest wins, the two best games they've played maybe in the playoffs, with the exception of that third game in Philadelphia, have come after the long rest. So I think that certainly helps. You have time to... The Avery Bradley situation, as it has unfolded, when Doc Rivers coached in Orlando, the worst thing about not having Grant Hill was that it was like the longest, for a lot of those years, it was the longest day-to-day injury of all time. Like you literally didn't know. He'd get to the ballpark every night. Is Grant going to play tonight? I don't know. And that makes it difficult to game plan. The Celtics weren't really preparing. They weren't going into this playoff series expecting not to have Avery Bradley, and his situation has gotten progressively worse. Literally, on before Game 6, the day before Game 6, we were talking about day-to-day, and in the pregame, in the arena, all of a sudden it went from day-to-day to he's probably not coming back to the playoffs. And that is a huge, dramatic swing when you're still hoping he can play, hoping he can give you 15, 20 minutes. That's a big change.
Well, who's making this call, ultimately?
Well, that really depends on who you ask, and since you are now asking me in front of everybody, I think that there's the other element in an NBA situation when you have a 21-year-old player who has not made money yet, who hasn't gotten to his big contract. You know, the agent is going to be involved in this situation, and he's going to be – a lot of different people are going to be pressuring Avery as to whether he should play or he shouldn't. You know, kids want to play. And decision-making is very difficult when a lot of different people are asking you different questions about, you know, and have different agendas about your career. Obviously, he's in a great deal of discomfort. It doesn't take much. You saw the Elton Brand hit earlier in the series. It doesn't take much to make a bad situation worse. He's going to have surgery, and that much we know. So the question is, what is the upside of him gutting it out? And it's different. Here's how you should think about it as a 21-year-old player. If you're Paul Pierce and you've got something wrong right now, you're Kevin Garnett or you're Ray Allen, and the phrase you invoked earlier, the finish line is close, you know this is the last ride, or most likely the last ride. So you just, you know, you're gutting it out, and whatever's left of your body when it's over, you know what you're, you know, you know what's on the line, and you know you've made your money, you've had your career, and you're going to the Hall of Fame. If you're 21, and all of a sudden different people are telling you things could be in jeopardy, and your future could be in jeopardy if you continue to play, that's gonna you know, play in your head a little bit, and you have to wrestle with the other side of that coin. I don't know how much Avery Bradley is hearing the following statement, which is, do you want to be Dan Marino? You know, you think when you're on a team like this in your first couple of years, you're thinking, well, this is the way it is every year. You get a chance to play for a championship. You go into the conference finals with a chance to beat Miami and play in the NBA finals, but it's not. And all of a sudden, you can play another 10, 12 years and never have an opportunity like this. And these are the different things you have to, you know, you have to wrestle with. You know, Big Baby thought this was going to be his life every year, was going to the conference finals and going to the NBA finals. Now he's in Orlando. You know, who knows who his coach and GM is going to be, if Dwight Howard's going to be there. And all of a sudden, he could be in a long-term situation on a losing team in Orlando. Who knows if he'll get another chance. So these are the things you have to weigh, and that is an awful lot to ask of a 21-year-old to deal with the different pressures on him.
What were the odds 3 months ago that we were going to spend 5 minutes on a podcast talking about Avery Bradley?
Zero.
Zero? I would have said 20-1.
You like to handicap that stuff. The same odds when I told you at the start of the year that your Los Angeles Kings were going to win the Stanley Cup, and I was mocked by you and everybody else. And now,
not my Los Angeles
here
Kings.
Here we are.
They're my daughters.
You love them.
I've had season tickets.
You love them the way you love all the other teams. You find the flaws in them, and then you complain, and you have difficulty all year, and you spend the entire year bitching about Dustin Penner, and then, you know, he scores the goal to send him to the Stanley Cup final.
Couple of notes here. One, I went to probably 15 1-0 or 2-1 games that were just dreadfully boring, and I have no idea how the Kings became this offensively capable team that can at any point, you know, get a good shot or whatever. I just playoff hockey is amazing to me. I watched this team all year. I went to the games. They did not have whatever is happening right now in them, which makes me think, just throw away the regular season. It obviously means nothing.
The NHL has a bigger argument for that, and it's funny, in this NBA year is far more like an NHL season than any other. I don't really buy the whole lockout short season. I don't like the comparisons to 99. I think that is overstated. 66 is a lot of games. But because of the guys didn't come back, it's more of the guys didn't come back in shape and the injuries that happened. All of a sudden, you know, we're talking about a seventh game with an eighth seed in it. That isn't as surprising. I don't know how much different the standings would have been had it been a full 82 versus 66. But the compressed season and the late start and the younger teams and the young galloping teams like Philadelphia and Portland getting off to a good start, that's what made the difference and made this more like, you know, an NHL season. I remember saying to somebody before that you're going to have multiple home teams lose in the first rounds of the playoffs because things weren't really settled the way they normally would have been. So this has been more like an NHL season. But that's a problem to me for the NHL, and that you really have to treat it as it's the entire season about making the, as Bill Parcells used to call the NFL playoffs, it's about making the tournament. And, you know, home court and home ice are two very, very different things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's good if you like the whole competitive thing and, you know, anything can happen from round to round. But it does seem like, you know, it doesn't matter what seed you are. The Kings have won eight or nine straight games on the road.
Yeah.
Like, that would never happen in basketball.
No.
So,
you know what? It comes from whether you're really just a hardcore NHL person who watches the NBA occasionally, or you're a hardcore NBA person that likes the NHL and watches the NHL. It's really more of what you're used to. So it's more disturbing, I think, to you because you have an NBA mindset. Whereas if you grew up in the NHL and it's just the way you're accustomed to it happening, it's like all of us that are old enough before interleague play, we like the way the schedule played out a certain way, and you're still not really used to like the interleague play. I know this really makes you sound old, but even now the interleague play, it's like there's something, you know, you like it and fans love it, but there's something that it's disturbing about the schedule and the way things were versus the way you like things a certain way. And the NBA and the NHL are like that. Play.
Well,
you've got to throw out the whole line.
I wouldn't say I'm disturbed by it. I'm more kind of flabbergasted by it because it's just weird to watch a team. It's the same guys, basically, that are playing a totally different way than they did during the 6 months that I spent going to the games and watching them. which makes me wonder, because we watched it happen last year with the Bruins, when they just went up a level. And you could see it. Like, wow, this is playing great. I wish they could always play like this. And then it just kind of keeps going. And, you know, you look at a guy like Penner, who was the most loathed guy in the stands, and now is probably like the third or fourth best king, and it makes you wonder, you know, I don't know what to make of it. But in basketball, I think the one thing from this 66 game season, I agree with you. It's not, I was there for the 99 season. I was going to those games, and they were an atrocity, and half the guys were out of shape, and it was just an awful season. This hasn't been like that. I think the one thing that I've been surprised by, Duncan and Garnett, who in the first 7-8 weeks, really, I mean, beyond the fact that they looked washed up, like it was to the point where you watched them and you actually felt kind of bad. Like I went to a Duncan game against the Clippers and I felt bad. Like he was playing on one leg and I was thinking, oh man, it's tough to see Timmy like this. And now he's playing the best he's played in 5 years. Same for Garnett, which makes me think like there's something about that extended layoff followed by all the quick games in a row that it just kind of took those guys, 10 weeks to play themselves back into shape? What's your explanation for what happened to KG here?
And also throw in two of the best coaches in the game, keenly aware of how those minutes need to be managed. And on that heading, under that umbrella of rest and Doc Rivers who never practices, it's really interesting how you are affected by your own experiences. Every coach, the fingerprint, the outline of what they do has to do with how they were sort of brought up in it. And remember that at the end of his career, when he was a veteran who needed rest, Doc Rivers was playing for Pat Riley, who would have, you know, hour and a half shoot-arounds and practice all the time and have these insane conditioning drills where you had to have, like, 1% body fat and, you know, get tested every day like he was on, you know, like he was a model or something. And that always stayed with him, and that is the reason that he is so careful about these veterans and their rest. The Garnett year cannot be understated, what he has accomplished at this age. You wrote the piece last year that is sort of it's the primer for the Dirk Nowitzki, Kevin Garnett era of players doing things at 34, 35, 36. Ray Allen, who last year, he's hurt now, but Ray Allen last year was having arguably his best year and broke the Reggie Miller record at going through a furious pace. Now, he wasn't like Hank Aaron hitting a home run every couple of weeks, breaking the home run record towards the end of his career. He was just breaking right through it like the Energizer Bunny. We'd never seen anything like this before. What Garnett has done, what's made this even more remarkable, at 36, he's having a year certainly as good as his best year since what should have been the MVP year in 08. He's having one of the best years of a 17-year career at 36, and he's doing it playing a different position. And among my many theories about Garnett in that he also senses the finish line and has, you know, done extraordinary things like a lot of these guys to keep himself in condition. He's a savant for the game defensively. I think the period of time that he was hurt after the knee injury, and particularly when he came back in the fall of 09, when he had some of those games you just talked about with Tim Duncan, when you looked at Kevin Garnett in the fall of 09 when he first came back, and you're like, wow, is this all it's going to be? Is he really sort of done now after this injury? I think he learned a different way to play when he was hurt, and he couldn't do as many things as he used to do. And I think his game actually evolved because of it. And the things that he's doing this year, and this really started when remarkably Jermaine O'Neal got hurt and missed a game at the beginning of the year, which is amazing.
I thought he was going to play every game.
It was like when Lou Gehrig sat down that night we got to Orlando and found out Jermaine wasn't going to play. Kevin Garnett played center in a January game against Dwight Howard, and he dominated Dwight Howard. And it was amazing to watch. And that would not have happened even 3 or 4 years ago when Garnett was playing at the MVP level in 08. He had a game against Eddie Curry in the preseason that he just couldn't deal with Eddie Curry because of the size difference and that he was a center. He was forced into playing center that night. And that game always stuck with me. And here it is years later, 4 years older, through the serious knee injury. And Kevin Garnett was able to dominate at the defensive end. And I think in the year that Garnett has had and what he has accomplished now for his career statistically, he's at a level with, you know, points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks that no one has ever done. No one has ever done what he's done, 20, 10, and 5, and then the 1,500 steals and blocks. It's never been done. And as he continues to just torch these milestones and climb the ladder, because there is no measure that you can put Garnett ahead of Tim Duncan because of the championships, I think he's nudging Duncan up the list. Kevin, because Kevin Garnett now, you have to have a serious, at one point this got a fairly intense conversation we had, very memorable on the plane, almost taking your concept of this top 15, top 20, and having some, you know, fairly big names and players and coaches in this debate about who was where. But you really have to look hard at Kevin Garnett now in the absolute VIP room of, you know, of the Hall of Fame. And I think from a basketball standpoint, I think as we sit here talking today, the odds of the Celtics and Spurs meeting in the finals obviously don't seem very good. But, boy, from a pure basketball standpoint, to watch Garnett and Duncan for seven games would have been awesome.
Yeah, you know, when I wrote the – I did the paperback kind of constructing that pyramid, assuming a couple things would happen, you know, mainly with some of these veteran guys that they would just start going down because that's what happened at a certain age. And now it's like you're just recalibrating everybody's expectations of how long somebody can play. I mean, I was talking to somebody about Steve Nash, about if you were the Knicks, would you sign Steve, like say Steve Nash said, I want a 3-year contract for your mid-level. Like in the old days, you'd be like, you're crazy. You're 39 years old. We're not giving you a 3-year contract. But now it's like, could he play until he's 42? Why not? He's in fantastic shape. You know, he obviously hasn't lost a step yet. He takes care of himself. We're in an age where guys are going to have 20 to 23, 24-year careers. They're stuck with Amar'e Stoudemire's contract anyway. It's not like they, you know, they're going to have cap space. They can't amnesty Amar'e. So why not go all in on Nash and have Nash and Jeremy Lin? You know, I just feel like, could KG play 3 more years? Like if KG came to the Celtics and said, I'll take 3 years, 30 to stay, I feel like I signed that contract.
I feel like they're going to have to. That's one of the fascinating things that's going to happen to the Celtics in the offseason is Kevin Garnett has played at this elite level. I thought he was, you know, he was in that neighborhood. There was a lot of good centers for the first time in forever, and you can make a debate. He was that, you know, the third best center, you know, all NBA third team. He played so well at that position.
Yeah.
But think about the guy you mentioned. You mentioned Steve. You're talking about Steve Nash. Steve Nash was the guy. How many years ago was this that Mark Cuban didn't want to give 4 years? Like now you're talking about would you consider giving Steve Nash a 3 or 4 year deal? And Mark Cuban didn't want to give him the years 5, 6 years ago.
No, it was 8 years ago. It was 2004.
Right. That's right, exactly. 2004. That's 2004. And Cuban didn't want to give him the years then, and now here we are. So obviously that's the biggest thing. The teams that win, executives that are successful, are the ones who see the things we're talking about now before they happen. You know, this was inconceivable in 2004.
We talked about the end of the finish line. This is the one thing that's changed about me with the Celtics team. Even from the stuff I was writing about right before the trade deadline about, I basically 2 days before was like, let's keep these guys together. They deserve one last chance here to put up a fight and then we'll blow up the team and start over. Now you look at it, you think, all right, let's say you get Kevin back for 2 years, $20 million with a team option for the third year, but if you buy it out, he gets $3 million. You know, do one of the, basically a 2-year contract with some extra money at the end. Then you keep Pierce, you have Bradley, you have Rajon Rondo, you have, you let Ray Allen go, you have enough cap space potentially to sign somebody for $8-9 million, as far as I can tell. Could you make another run here with and you have Bass and Steensma and some of these role guys? Could you potentially linger around next year? I feel like they could, you know, and a lot of it depends on whether KG will want to come back, whether he wants to play a couple more years. Cause I was hearing like in December, January, he was checked out and ready to, you know, he just didn't want to go through it anymore. And then something snapped, but does he have 2-3 years left in him? I feel like he does.
Based on what we've seen, the answer to that question is yes. You know, you didn't mention the one guy, and it's funny because, you know, now Ray Allen is banged up late in the year, obviously, but the issue with the Celtics was losing, it wasn't the quote-unquote big three or Rondo. It was the ancillary pieces that they needed. No one during this last few weeks has talked about Jeff Green and, by the way, Chris Wilcox. When you have Greg Steensma and Ryan Hollins, who've really struggled, obviously, in the playoffs, this is a different animal. To have, you know, veterans, you know, who know how to play, to be able to play those significant minutes the way, you know, they were able to salvage the Jeff Green, you know, Mikal Petras isn't Jeff Green, but he was able to give the Celtics, you know, veteran minutes, and he's been in these playoff situations. We're walking into the Garden tomorrow night for a Game 7, and when the Celtics lost the Game 7 there 3 years ago, it was Petras the one who beat him with all those threes for Orlando. So it's, again, ironic that these are the guys we're talking about, Jeff Green, Chris Wilcox, Avery Bradley. If the younger ancillary players are healthy for the Celtics, they're the ones who haven't, you know, who weren't able to be healthy when it mattered most.
And potentially two first round picks.
Right.
If they choose to use
but it's a good draft.
Yeah, if they choose to use the Clipper pick, they could always package them together and trade up or whatever. I personally would not use the Clipper pick because I always think it's just nice to stash those Clipper picks away, roll them over, and just let the Clippers do their thing. You know,
that was the greatest example of, I've always believed there is an element of self-immolation when it comes to not wanting to get on a plane to go back to play another playoff game. And that end of the fourth game with the Clippers and the Spurs was the best example of the last couple of minutes of a team that just did not want to get on a plane and play that fifth game. Just the crazy mistakes, the bad shots, everything that happens late in the game when a team does not. This is the theory that I remain the most surprising outcome of any game I have ever been through in the 14 years I've been doing this, was that the Celtics didn't win the championship in Game 5 in L.A. Because that game had all the elements of a team's about, you know, you don't want to fly 3,000 miles to take a beating, and now we know why, of what happened in Game 6 and 08. And just, I still remain shocked that game ended the way that, you know, the way that it did. It was a great season for the Clippers. Boy, that was a perfect example of do not want to get on a plane.
So what's your prediction for Game 7? Do you have one?
I think this has been a series that, and generally a playoff year, that you look pretty stupid when you make these bold, you know, these bold statements. And that's, of course, we are conditioned now. We live in a world of ESPN where everybody comes on. I'm talking about the EKG of the playoffs, where you come on the next day and, Miami's down 2-1 and everybody has to make these bold statements about how it's over for Miami. And even yesterday, pretty much everyone was convinced that Indiana was going to win that game and force Game 7 because Haslam wasn't there. But again, this is sort of not what we know about the playoffs. I think Philadelphia has gone as far as they can go. It has been, you know, remarkable. I think that this series is determined, as most Celtic games are now, unless Kevin Garnett has an out-of-body, all-world night, when he has had several in this season, particularly in the playoffs. What I thought Game 6, the closing game against Atlanta, I made this statement on Sports Nation, in fact. That was the best game that any Celtic individually has played in the new Big 3 era, including Pierce against Cleveland, including Ray Allen in Chicago. That's how dominant it was. So he could do that. But for the most part, it's which Rondo are you going to get? And going back and forth, as the Celtics have, they're in a Game 7 in the second round because they have gone head-to-head with Jeff Teague and Jrue Holiday through the first 12 games of the playoffs. And Rondo has not separated himself from those two guys. My guess is tomorrow night it's going to be a Rondo game. And for the Celtics to do any kind of damage and to have that puncher's chance even against Miami, Rondo has to be that guy who's head and shoulders above. He's the reason the Celtics beat Cleveland and knocked LeBron out 2 years ago in 2010, because they didn't have anybody who could deal with him. And I think most likely the same thing happens tomorrow.
Yeah, Rondo's hit the ceiling a couple times.
Yeah.
But then you have a game like Game 6 where you could just tell in the first 5 minutes. I know you credited Doug Collins to clogging the lane and all that stuff. I agree that they changed a couple of things. It did help. But you can tell when Rondo's engaged and when he's not.
Absolutely.
And it was the same thing.
There's
like
no,
Game 3 was another one. Game 3, it was like, oh, Rondo's here. You know, and he just knew in the first 2 minutes. And he's just been one of those guys. I feel like Saturday night, the stage is set for one of those classic Rondo games. You could have a nice drunk crowd, 3-day weekend.
8 o'clock start.
8 o'clock. People, what time do people start drinking? Maybe 3 o'clock? You know, nice drunk rowdy crowd. And
it started about 7 o'clock tonight.
Right.
And it goes in.
And Rondo feeds off the energy to a big degree, and that's why he loves that those nationally televised games so much. Of course, Game 6 was nationally televised, but I agree. I think the one thing that I would bet on, I'd bet on two things. I'd bet on a big KG game, and I'd bet on a big Rondo game. But I don't know if I trust anyone else. I got to be honest. Like, I don't. Since Pierce sprained his knee, I just think it's really tough for him to score. It compromises a lot of what he does.
He's been better against. Iguodala was tremendous against him early in the series, but Paul Pierce, he hasn't shot the ball well, but he gets to the free throw line. He'll compete. He's been great in game seven, so you're right.
Normally this would be healthy Paul Pierce gets to the line 17 times in this game. The one-legged Paul Pierce, a little different. And I think he shot like 13 free throws in game six, which I was surprised by. But, and this is why the Miami is just looming, because they have no chance against Miami if Pierce is at 60% or whatever, because they just need him to at least land a couple punches on LeBron. I'm not saying he has to win every round, but he at least needs to like stagger him once or twice. And if he's on one leg the way LeBron's playing right now, makes me nervous.
Paul Pierce plays LeBron really as well as anybody because of familiarity. They've played against each other like 55 times, counting the preseason. It's amazing. So they really know, what the other is going to do, and that gives, it helps LeBron against Paul Pierce defensively, but that's one of the reasons Pierce plays him as well as anyone. The wild card for Game 7 that I think is going to be the Achilles heel for the Celtics against Miami, if it happens that way, is a subtle thing happened in Game 6. Doug Collins had to pick his poison and obviously decided it wasn't going to be Rondo or Garnett that beat him. Well, an interesting thing happened. They let Ray Allen shoot. Ray Allen had a bad Game 6, obviously, but they let him shoot. And if that continues and Ray Allen hits a shot or two early, this could end up being a big Ray Allen night offensively in Game 7. That could be the other guy, not Paul Pierce, that ends up doing major damage to Philadelphia. But obviously, if you look ahead to the next round, this is where everything turns. And if you had Avery Bradley against Dwayne Wade versus Ray Allen now, a hobbled Ray Allen against Dwayne Wade, that's a big problem.
Yeah, Ray Allen is – you can't even put a percentage on it. I'd say he's like at 40%. Maybe. I just don't think he can move.
He's 81 night and then 40 the next night.
He can't move. You can see it the most whenever Philly gets a situation where they can attack him one-on-one. He can barely, go left to right. I feel bad for him. And you mentioned earlier about how Bradley, he's 21 and he's got future contracts. I really respect Ray Allen because, he has one more big free agent contract in him. And he's certainly not helping his cause right now with the way he's playing, but he's out there gutting it out. So I respect that guy.
People will hear this later in the afternoon. So just so you know that we actually check Twitter while we do this, as that glimmer of hope, that Avery Bradley glimmer of hope, that's gone because he's going to have the surgery today.
Wow, that's
sort of what we expected, but it was always that there was always that chance that is now gone. So now all of these things that we're talking about are are reality, and this is what. Again, the puncher's chance. This is what my sense of it was. People were talking the last couple of weeks, and everyone was getting very excited, saying, "Hey, if Miami doesn't have Chris Bosh, the Celtics have a real chance to beat Miami in the conference finals." And my counter to that the last couple of days was, if the Celtics don't have Avery Bradley on Dwayne Wade, then it's going to be very, very, very difficult. Now, if Boston wins Game 7 against Philly, do they make that a series? Do they make that competitive? Do they make Miami work? I don't think. Remember, last year happened. Last year was a five-game series. The two games in Miami were not competitive, but it was starting, as you said, it was starting to make that turn into a competitive series. And then when the Rondo injury, the Rondo injury happened, they didn't have Rondo last year, who's the wild card that can make this a competitive series. And as long as you've got Rondo and the potential of him playing at that crazy high level for an entire series, it could be interesting.
Would you just throw away Game 1?
I will tell you. We had a Doc and I were joking about that after Game 6 was about the way this crazy season has gone, that you might as well, the Celtics had a game late in the year where they played, and the schedule, which was insane, obviously had the Celtics playing a game in Newark on a Saturday, in Charlotte on a Sunday, and then flying back to New York into the same hotel to play the Knicks in the next game. So the Celtics literally did not bring Paul Pierce or Kevin Garnett to Charlotte. We just flew down there. They weren't on the flight and played the game without them the next day. And it was, you're almost joking, like throwaway Game 1. Because I said that the most surprising result in the 14 years I've been doing this was the Celtics losing Game 5. The most surprising result would be if the Celtics beat Philadelphia and then win Game 1 in Miami. That would
replace
it as the most shocking result of everything we know about the NBA. So I think that would be that wouldn't happen. But of course, you'd have an I think you'd have an extremely quick leash if that game got out of hand quickly.
Oh, FYI, I wasn't kidding. I don't know if I put Garnett, Pierce, and Ray Allen on that plane. Just have them join the team, or put them in street clothes. Or, they're going to have to be there anyway, so you bring them. But, what are the odds they win game one after a bloodbath of a game seven?
Staggering. Yeah, in fact, you go back to 09 when this team was 3 years younger, and they got pushed to, obviously the classic Chicago series. They got, they got destroyed by Orlando in game one, and that was also 2 days later. And now you're facing arrested, LeBron, and they start forcing turnovers and galloping up the floor. It could be, it really could be a mess. So,
all right, Sean Grandy. Anyone with Sirius driving around this weekend, you can listen to his call on ESPN Extra. I think that's the channel tomorrow night. Hopefully, we'll talk again during the playoffs, and the Celtics will be alive for a couple more weeks. Take care.
Anytime, my friend.
All right, we're gonna call my buddy Jacko right now, just because rumors that the Yankees might be for sale. I don't believe them, but it's fun to think about. Let's get his take.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, Johnny, I'm buying the Yankees.
Nice. Awesome. I'll throw in $100 of my own money.
How great would that be if I had $3 billion and I bought the Yankees with the intent to just destroy them?
Oh, no, that would not be awesome.
That would be a good sports movie.
That really would.
Evil billionaire buys a team and just starts trying to... It would almost be a little bit like Major League, but almost more nefarious. It'd be a better TV show, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. That would be pretty good.
We've traded CC Sabathia for John Lackey. Do you believe that the Yankees will be sold?
I do not, because the Steinbrenner family, specifically Hal Steinbrenner, came out very quickly with a categorical denial of the New York Daily News report that there was inklings of rumors of stirrings that they were potentially going to explore possibilities of putting them up for sale. And, I mean, while I understand that they would probably look longingly, seeing that the Dodgers just sold for $2 billion and the Yankees are a better name brand sports franchise than the Dodgers,
yeah,
they could probably figure they can make $3 billion from it. But as I read somewhere yesterday, I mean, it's not like the Yankees don't make money as it is. Between the YES Network and the stadium and everything else associated with being in the Yankees, I mean, those guys have a license to print money. So I don't really understand why you would sell it. It's not like working in a coal mine or you're losing, hemorrhaging money. So I don't understand why they would sell it.
I think that $3 billion number is low. What am I getting? Am I getting the YES Network with that?
Yeah, you get Yankee Stadium, and you get the YES Network.
I think that number is low. I think it's like four.
Yeah, but I mean, they make a lot of money per year. I mean, they make money from the YES Network. They make money from the team.
That's what I'm saying. I think those three things together are worth more than $3 billion because they're also bringing in profits every year.
Yeah, so they could get more than that. But, I mean, they own it now, free and clear. I mean, I don't know if they've done any kind of leveraging or anything, but, their father bought the team for about I think the price was $9 million in 1973, of which he put up like $100,000, literally. Yeah. So they've more than made their money back a billion times over, a trillion times over. So I don't understand why you would have an impetus to sell. Now, I don't think that they love baseball and they don't have the passion for it that their father had. And it's always been odd to me that neither Hal nor Hank were ever supposed to be the guy that was supposed to be in charge. It was supposed to be his son-in-law,
yep,
Steve Swindle. So I could never understand that, because if my father owned the Yankees, like, I would have been there every day as a kid and would have been salivating to take over the team. I would have been the Jerry Buss of the Yankees. Was that his son's name, Jerry Buss?
Jimmy.
Jr.?
You would have been the Jimmy Buss.
Jimmy Buss of the Yankees. I'd have been all over everything. Or the Angelo sons, or any of these legacy guys that, what's his name, the guy that owns the Colts, Irsay.
Yeah.
I would have been salivating to take over the team. So I can't understand not having a passion to run it. But even not having a passion to run it, I think they feel some obligation to their father to keep the team and the family. And there's no real need to sell it, because it's not – I mean, if you're hemorrhaging money, it's one thing, let's get out while we can make a profit. But I don't really think that's the case, so I was surprised to see that story when I woke up yesterday.
The only reason I could see them selling is for what you just said. They don't really totally love the team. They don't totally love the spotlight. You know, the team is probably never going to be worth more than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you just cash in, like sitting at the blackjack table. Just look at
before it starts to go down.
Yeah. It would be really fun if the Yankees had a new owner, especially if it was kind of like a modern-day Steinbrenner type of owner that would be totally polarizing and kind of like a Daniel Snyder type.
Well, that's what I worry about is, I mean, you know, you could end up with a Frank McCourt type who could run the brand into the ground. I mean, you know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. Now, I don't think they're their father, but, you know, they're still willing to spend money to some degree and are relatively hands-off and let Cashman and the baseball people run things. But, I mean, you could just get somebody in there that is just a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? I mean,
The way Red Sox fans have felt a little bit the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, at least those guys brought you a couple World Series. But yeah,
yes.
You know, you have the. Well, that was my biggest fear. I'm like, what if Lucchino bought them or something? I'd really have a hard time with that.
Please.
If he broke off from the Red Sox group because he wants to go off on his own, I'm like, God, imagine if Lucchino bought the Yankees. I wouldn't know how to handle that.
Johnny, I look at the American League East standings right now, and they're upside down.
Yes.
It goes Baltimore, Tampa, Toronto, Yankees, Boston.
Yeah.
Somehow, the Yankees and Boston combined are 45-43.
Yeah. Everybody else in baseball is excited about that.
Baltimore's 11 games over 500 somehow.
It's really unbelievable.
Best record in the AL.
It's incredible. I mean, there's nobody that predicted that, right?
No.
Nobody.
No. There was actually inklings that I had read some stuff like either them or Toronto, one of those two teams could be a little young and frisky.
Yeah, but I thought people like Toronto is the young, frisky one more than Baltimore.
Yeah, oh, it was definitely more Toronto, but there was a couple of maybe, you know, a little Baltimore. But what's weird is that you look at their stats and like obviously Adam Jones is having a big year, but other
right.
than that, I don't totally get it. It feels a little fluky to me.
Yeah, I can't see it sustaining itself, quite frankly, with that pitching staff that they have. I'll believe it when I see it. If they go wire to wire and they win the AL East or make the playoffs, I'll tip my cap to them. But I'm going to put that in the I'll believe it when I see it category.
You're not a fan of Jason Hamill, Wee-Yin Chin, and Brian Matthews?
Not really. Although Wee-Yin Chin made the Yankees look silly. I think it was last week. But a lot of teams have made the Yankees' offense look silly lately, so I'm not sure we can put a lot of credence in that.
I've had a lot of trouble getting into baseball this year just because of the NBA and the NHL playoffs. I feel like I've been at the Staples Center like every other night for the past 6 weeks.
It seems like you have.
There's so much television, playoff television on. It's really hard to get excited to flick over to Nesson to see these outfielders I've never heard of in my life. Who's that guy?
See if Andrew Miller's holding a lead.
Yeah, that guy's batting fifth. Where'd he come from?
I mean, I feel somewhat the same way. And I mean, not that I've had much interest in the NBA, but I have watched some playoff hockey on TV because playoff hockey is just downright interesting and exciting, edgier seat stuff. And so I have watched hockey, but you put on the Yankees and just to watch another bases loaded, nobody out, can't get a run-in situation, and I just pull out more and more hair, and it just drives me nuts. So they've just demoralized me.
The Red Sox getting to 500.
Pretty quickly.
Before Memorial Day, I would not have predicted that.
It's true.
It really felt like a 72-90 type season.
Yeah,
especially like
still maybe.
Crawford and Ellsbury knocked out, basically, and then after the Beckett thing, like, just assumed that he was a Section 8, and he's actually pitched pretty well since then.
Well, the interesting thing about the Red Sox season is that they've had, like, about three different rock-bottom situations.
Yeah.
And then they seem to crawl out of it, and then they hit another rock-bottom situation. So they've been hot lately, so I think we're pretty much due for another rock-bottom situation. You know, Beckett lasting a third of an inning, or Lester lasting only an inning, or some ungodly lead blown by the bullpen. So I'm excited for that.
I know that you loved when that week when everybody turned on Adrian Gonzalez.
I
did. It was
did.
Like people had run out of fingers to point. It was like, let's get this guy. Get him! Never jumped out of Coyotes. Coyotes came after Adrian.
Well, the interesting thing is at the time of that trade, and obviously, you know, I always get reports on this on Twitter. You know, in my typical rational fashion, I claimed a conspiracy or something because the Red Sox basically got this guy that was a triple crown threat for nobody. And you threw out the name of Rizzo, and I know that became a famous thing, obviously, in our podcast history about Rizzo and the second coming of Babe Ruth. But now, as it turns out, Adrian Gonzalez has, like, no pop whatsoever. He's basically Wade Boggs. And Rizzo at AAA is threatening Roger Maris' home run record or something. So it's crazy. He's hitting, like, 380 with, like, 16 home runs, and the Cubs are, you know, he's the Bryce Harper of the Cubs. So maybe that trade wasn't as ridiculous as I originally thought.
And we threw in Casey Kelly, who was probably the top prospect on the team at the time. I don't
know
what he's doing. I haven't checked in on old Casey lately, but
you must get the tweets about Rizzo as well, right?
Yeah, I don't really like the Rizzo tweets that much.
No, I can imagine.
Gonzalez thing's pretty weird because he's claiming he's healthy.
Right.
He's three home runs.
And every reporter/fanboy always wants to claim that, he's got this shoulder issue, which allegedly he claims is not an issue.
Well,
and then everybody points to the home run derby from last year because did he win it or he went to the finals of the home run derby or something? And everybody claimed that screwed up his swing. But, I mean, we're like almost a year beyond that. It shouldn't be screwed up anymore, right?
The part that doesn't make sense is a little like the Pujols thing where when the on-base goes in the tank. That's the part that gets weird.
Yeah.
If you've established a pattern of 40% of the time you get on base and now all of a sudden it's 33%, that's a little strange.
Well, if you're used to hitting the ball out and you're not, maybe you start to press a little bit and you're swinging at bad pitches because you're trying to make something happen. I don't know.
There's been so much bad stuff to talk about and write about that Ortiz's resurgence kind of got swept under the rug. You know, now this is a guy that I think I wrote 3 years ago that, you know, how sad it was to watch. They're going to have to release him soon.
Right.
I don't know what, you know, this year he's looked great. He lost some weight.
Yeah.
And somebody
I'm
that
sure the,
really,
the reasons for his resurgence probably literally got swept under the rug.
Oh, Johnny, come on. We don't need that.
Didn't he lash out the other day, though, something about leadership and kind of threw everybody's binky, Dustin Pedroia, under the bus?
I think
and it kind of came out of nowhere. Like, I don't know what he was offended about.
Yeah, it seems like it's really tough to play in Boston. And it's just day after day after day after day of all these different websites and newspapers and radio stations and drive time shows, and like everybody's upping the ante for who they can pick apart. And I think he just kind of snapped. Because I was reading the stories thinking like, there must be something to this. And it really wasn't. It just seemed like he's just fed up.
Yeah.
Just had it. It was like a non-story that became a giant story, but
it's weird to snap when the team is playing well, though.
I know. I think he got frustrated. You and I, you and I both have tempers. I think it was just
Absolutely.
One of those things where it's like he kind of flipped out. But yeah, I think the media scene in Boston is really interesting right now. There's just so many different outlets. It's certainly a lot more. Like I remember when I had my old website in the '90s. There's one radio station, two newspapers, and nobody on the internet. And now you. Four different websites now on top of the two all-day radio stations.
Yeah, the two radio stations is interesting because that's probably, you know, if you're tired of listening to yourself get bashed on one channel, you can flip and get bashed on another channel if you're a Red Sox player.
Yeah, and both of them are pretty negative shows. How are you feeling about Pujols with his 625 OPS right now?
Well, remember we did this before in the preseason? We talked about that contract and I said, they're not going to get much out of that contract. And then I said something about this year, and then I retracted that. It turns out it was like a Freudian slip. I was oddly prescient. I thought it would be a couple of years down the line they'd be regretting that contract, much the way the Yankees regret the A-Rod contract. But the regret came early for Pujols.
I don't know if I'd write him off, but it's been pretty funny how, like in March, the Pujols billboards, the Dodgers were – you know, could not have been more of a catastrophe. And everybody, a big thing out here was the Angels. Could this be their chance to steal Dodgers territory? And then, like, you know, in the matter of weeks, Magic and his group buy the Dodgers, although Magic put in about as much money as you would have put in.
Yes.
He put in 10 bucks. So all of a sudden they buy it. Everybody's excited, new owners. Dodger, Matt Kemp comes out, like, just as Roy Hobbs. The Dodgers
right.
come flying out of the gate, and the Angels go the other way. They're a disaster. Pujols is awful. And, like, in 3 weeks it was over. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're Dodger country.
Yeah, right.
And the Angels kind of missed their window. So even if they turn it around now, I think they missed their one chance to really grab that, strangle it out here.
They had to get rid of poor Mickey Hatcher. Was it Mickey Hatcher who was the hitting coach that they had to get rid
yeah,
of?
Yeah, yeah. He was
like Mike Socha's best friend.
He's a sacrificial lamb. The big losers were the Kings because you had the Dodgers sale and the Pujols thing, and then you had two basketball playoff teams, both of who made the second round. And
mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the Kings, like, they made the cup finals once in 44 years. It was like their one chance to be like, hey, look at
spotlight.
Us. Like, barely mentioned. Really, it's like.
And they were like an eight seed, right?
Oh, yeah. It's an awesome story. And they just, you know, the Lakers.
Dominant.
And the Clippers, and just people care more about basketball here.
Their goalie is Connecticut's own.
Oh, I know. He's like a prep school kid.
Yeah, the Kings get a lot of play here in Connecticut because we don't have the Whale anymore, so they've had articles about the kid who's their goalie.
He's amazing, too.
If you're Gary Bettman, I mean, you have to be David Stern-esque here, and you have to fix it so it's Rangers-Kings, right?
You'd think.
I mean, they want New York against L.A. There's nobody that wants the Devils there. Nobody.
You know, it's funny though. That I was talking about this
in New Jersey, but
I was talking about this in the office yesterday with Chris Ryan and Sarah, who work for who run the Triangle Blog. The like on paper, it's like, yeah, New York, LA, it'll be awesome ratings. But that assumes that people in Los Angeles would watch hockey.
Yeah, true.
Which it's like, yeah, LA, awesome ratings, but I there's still that missing piece of people watching, turning on.
The awesome ratings for the NHL is like what, like a million people?
Yeah, I don't know. I it's weird because I really got into hockey the last 18 months or so, and especially like this year, like, you know, turning on SportsCenter, and you always hear people complain about ESPN that ESPN buries hockey, all that stuff.
Right.
And it's kind of true. I hate to throw a dart at the worldwide leader, but. You go on SportsCenter to watch the hockey highlights, and they don't come on until like the 35-minute mark of SportsCenter. There was a day the other day, they were showing National League highlights of two. It was like the Cubs and the. It was two teams that weren't even 500. And they showed like 3 minutes of highlights from this game, and then like 10 minutes later, they showed the NHL playoff highlights.
I mean, I don't want to be a corporate shill here, but don't they do that for a reason, though? I mean, they must know their audience, right?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I was thinking, like, there has to be some sort of real science to this. And somebody must have determined that, you know, there's indisputable evidence that there's no way hockey should go, you know, within these first 20 minutes of SportsCenter unless X, X, and X is in place.
I mean, in America, hockey is sort of a niche sport. And the people that are feverishly into hockey sort of guard that feverishly, too. You know, it's hard to get in to be we've talked about this before, I think, but it's hard to get in and be a hockey fan because they're very territorial and it's like, this is our thing and you have to know the starting lineup of the 1928 Canadians in order to really get in the club, you know?
Yep. And, you know, I don't know if that's a great thing because you can't have it both ways because you can't say, oh, these people suck. They never talk about hockey. Nobody ever read. But then on the other hand, get mad at anybody who tries to get into hockey.
Exactly.
You know, and I feel like from my end, like I probably went to 30 Kings games this year.
Right.
You know, but I still feel like I would be afraid to express my opinions on things because, well, first of all, I still don't know what the F's going on as we've talked about. I've been to 30 games and as far as I can tell, there's no rhyme or reason to anything that happens other than the effort of the guys. Like, hey guys, crash the corners, crash the net. All right. And that's it. I really don't feel like there's a ton of strategy. Maybe there is, and I just can't see it. And maybe I'm just blind.
It's kind of like dump it in on goal and wait for something to happen, get a rebound, whatever, you know? I don't know if there's any set plays, really. Maybe on power plays, but...
Maybe.
A lot of dumping it in and hoping something happens.
Yeah, you need – it seems like you need specific things. Like you definitely – your defensemen need to be able to clear out the guy who's trying to stand in front of the goalie and block his view.
Yeah.
You definitely need those – you need the defenseman who can just get that guy the hell out of there. And on the flip side, you need to have guys who can stand in front of the net and get in the goalie's way. And then you need the guys who can fight in the corners. You need the one or two guys who can create shots. You need some speed. You need energy. But for the most part, I don't know. Like, I'll go to basketball. Like, I went to those Spurs-Clipper games, and, you know, like, there's, like, this whole other level of what's going on that I can see. And in hockey, it's just energy. Like, Phoenix beat the Kings in Game 4. The Kings are trying to sweep them. And they just tried harder, and their goalie played better. It was like, he left, and it's like, yeah, I guess that's what happened. Maybe more happened. Maybe they did stuff, but I didn't see it.
Well, like watching 24/7, they're always like, "All right, boys, go! You gotta skate hard now. Skate him.
Yeah,
he's skating. It's like in football, they're not like, run. You gotta run, run harder, run faster. You know, there's like plays, there's things to do, not just like running or skating.
But it's somehow 24.
Skating seems of paramount importance.
24/7 didn't help with this whole thing. They should have told the coaches to make up strategy. Hey, guys. Let's run the power wing today, okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to go out there and run the power wing and run variable B and C with that, okay? Let's go.
We're going to get so many angry tweets, it's not even funny, from people in Canada and other hockey aficionados that tell us we don't know what the hell we're talking about.
Oh, I'd be the first to admit I'm probably right. Missing a lot. I've been watching hockey since I was a kid, and to me, I'm sure there's some science to what's going on, but I think most of it's instinctive.
Yeah.
I don't think the coach is going out there between, you know, going into the locker room between the first and second periods and saying like, hey guys, I picked up on three things they're doing.
Yeah.
Number one, here are the answers. Number one, blank. Number two, blank. Like I just don't think that happens. It really seems like it's effort.
Yeah.
Everything else. It's just like, go out there and try harder than them. All right, let's do it, fellas.
And it's all about having a hot goalie. If your goalie's playing well, that's all you need. You can get hot in a series, and you know anybody can beat anybody with a good goalie.
Well, the other thing with the hot goalie, I have been thinking about. I do think there's another level to it because it's not only that the goalie is making plays. The other guys get so much confidence that they have that goalie behind them that they can take more chances. And you're not. They played in the second round. St. Louis had this guy Elliott. You could just tell the other team had no confidence, that they had no confidence in Elliott. And they were just bummed out. You know, it was like almost
you have to play perfectly, I guess, because if you let one get by you, the goalie's letting it in too. So if you have Lundqvist for the Rangers, who I guess has been playing well, although they're losing in the series, but I guess he's been playing well, feed off that because he's standing on his head to make, you know, saves. So. And the other, it has to be frustrating for the other team, too, when you've dominated a period and you can't get the puck in the net. So it's huge.
So both of those games, Elliott's in there. And first of all, you can tell he was shaky because the guys that skate over, they're always, like, doing the ritual stuff. And you could tell they were really, like, into the ritual stuff, like the good luck, tapping his pads and stuff.
Yeah.
And on top of that – any three-syllable goalie is in trouble when the crowd can smell it because they do the Elliott.
Yeah.
It's like Smith is the goalie for this round, and it's really tough to come up with a good Smith chant.
Yeah, it doesn't work quite as well.
So they try to do the "You suck, Smith," or I'm sorry, "Smith, you suck" has been the chant, but it's not as good as Elliott. It's not as good as singing Elliott's name. But, man, he would give up one goal, and then the whole crowd just going, Elliott.
I was watching the Rangers game. I guess it was – I forget if it was game one or game two against the Devils. And the whole Garden crowd had the Marty from Martin Brodeur. That was pretty good.
It's the best. Lundqvist is so handsome. Brian Gumbel's still talking about it.
You know, they had an article in Sports Illustrated about Lundqvist and how he's the king and he can't walk anywhere in New York without, you know, people mobbing him.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess he can probably walk down the street without being mobbed.
I'm going to say he's safe.
I think Derek Jeter has problems walking down the street. I think Lundqvist's okay.
I'm going to say Lindquist could go about 5-6 blocks without anybody really stopping him.
No problem. Yeah, I would think.
Yeah. I don't think he's be like, oh, crap, we got to take a cab. I can't walk 6 blocks. I'm the Rangers goalie.
Exactly. Yeah, I would dispute that, yeah.
Well, I hope the Rangers win. I think a Rangers-Kings finals.
Yeah, it would be entertaining.
Would be tremendous. You didn't see the end of Kings Coyotes, right?
Yeah, no. The last game. That's my bedtime. I watched some of it.
It was late.
And I commented on this on Twitter about how Phoenix had the whiteout, but the Kings were wearing white jerseys.
I know. I felt like it helped the Kings.
It happened in the NBA, too. I think it was the Mavericks Thunder, and everybody for the Mavericks was wearing blue, and I perfectly matched the Thunder away uniforms.
Right.
And then I heard on Twitter, a lot of people have told me, almost as many people that told me why Maine celebrates Patriots Day. Number two in this was people telling me that it was a tradition that came from Winnipeg because the Coyotes used to be the Winnipeg Jets. So everybody would have the whiteout that originated in Winnipeg, and they just continued it in Phoenix, which is lame on any number of levels to carry on the tradition from the team that you stole. But when your opponent is wearing white and then everybody's wearing white in the arena, it seems a little disconcerting.
I 100% agree. And on top of that, I the whole concept of everybody wearing the same color eludes me. The Clippers the Clippers did it against the Spurs. Do you think the Spurs are like, ah, this red, this sea of red, it's intimidating.
Indiana did it last night against the Heat. Everybody was wearing yellow shirts. It didn't seem to bother Miami too much either.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah,
all right,
exactly.
Well, let's hope we get Rangers Kings. Johnny, I'm glad the Yankees aren't for sale. I know you love the old man, and you're glad they're protecting his legacy.
Absolutely,
Enjoy the weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
You too, buddy.
Target to set off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.